Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to a Tuesday edition of the RotoWire NBA podcast. Nick Whalen joined, as always, by Alex Perutha. We also have a third man on the pod today. James Anderson is back with us on short notice, nonetheless, to break down the NBA playoffs. James, appreciate you hopping on. Alex, great to talk to you, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. All right, we got a lot to get to, as always. We're recording this Tuesday late afternoon, so we have Celtics-Nets Game 5, Blazers-Nuggets Game 5, and Lakers-Suns Game 5 later this evening. We'll shy away from trying to break down those contests, which by the time you're listening to this will either be over or probably about to start. But we'll hit those series more generally, and we'll talk about a lot of the action from the weekend and maybe look ahead to some of the second-round series that are already coming into view. But I want to go to Clippers-Mavs right away, which this series looked completely over. I had said to you last week, Alex, on the pod, I couldn't believe that the favorite outcome, according to the DraftKings Sportsbook, at least the one with the lowest odds, was Mavericks in four after taking the first two in L.A. That series is now completely flipped. Luka Doncic is banged up. He could barely move his neck in game four. It would be very surprising if he ultimately misses any time. But, man, this one has just completely flipped on a dime from, how we viewed this Clippers team and frankly, how we viewed this Mavs team 4 or 5 days ago.
Well, I mean, if Luka Doncic isn't going to be 100% healthy, it's tough to have a lot of faith in the Mavericks. Like, his numbers for the series are still good. He's averaging 33 a game, the 8 assists. But, his neck injury, that holds the fate of Dallas to some extent. Because now that the series is tied, and you're going back to L.A., with a hurt Doncic, that's a rough way to go.
Yeah, I think this Mavs team's whole recipe for winning this series and making any kind of a run was just to kind of be like those LeBron Cavs teams where Doncic was just the best player on the court at all times and just kind of willed the players around him to the next round. But Kawhi Leonard's been the best player the last couple games, and the Mavs have stopped hitting threes at like a 50% clip. So, I think that they have the one thing that I would think about doing if I was serious about trying to get back into this series is to play Porzingis less, because I just think he's become such a defensive liability, especially when the Clippers are going small. But I don't really think that they are going to be willing to go that route. And yeah, I mean, the Doncic injury, the fact that Kawhi's playing at his current level, just sort of seems like it's all swung in the Clippers' favor.
I mean, Porzingis is averaging only 15-4 in the series in 32 minutes. That's like, I'm not like super low on Porzingis, but even the people who are low on Porzingis, 15-4 is atrocious.
I mean, what is the alternative if you're going to go away from Porzingis, if you're going to play him fewer minutes, play someone else more minutes? I mean, they went to Boban at times in the first and in the fourth quarter of game four. It kind of worked. I mean, obviously you're giving some very specific things up when you have him on the floor, but he is kind of this weird instant offense as a 7'4" big man. I mean, I don't really think that that's a sustainable option necessarily. I mean, if you're trading off Porzingis, does it mean you're just going small? You know, you're giving Trey Burke more minutes. You're giving Jalen Brunson, you know, Josh Richardson hasn't played that much. I mean, the last two games have just kind of been a reminder, I guess, of how good the Clippers can be when everything is running right. I don't think that it's now just going to be a runaway train and this is what they're going to look like the rest of the way. Like, Dallas obviously has a chance to still win the series tied 2-2, but I think they need Porzingis to do so, right? I mean, unless Doncic is just going completely insane and it's going to average, you know, 40 to 45 points a game and hit 5 to 8 threes the rest of the way, which given the neck issue, I don't think that's necessarily an option either. Like, I get what you're saying, James, in terms of, you know, less Porzingis, but I don't think they have like a great option behind him.
Well, what I would ideally, if Doncic and Maxi Kleber were both fully healthy, I think that small lineup of Doncic, Brunson, Hardaway, Finney-Smith, and Kleber could be really effective. But the fact that Kleber's not, like, I just don't think this version of Kleber is like capable of really stepping into that type of role as like a 25 minutes per game at the five type of guy. And I wonder if the Mavs like even really have a shot if they continue to just operate with Porzingis getting the minutes he has. I definitely recognize though that the other alternatives would probably open up other problems.
I mean, we knew they would be dependent on Doncic. His usage rate for the series, by the way, is 42%. That is 9 percentage points higher than anyone else. Brad Beal is second, Lillard is third, Morant fourth, and Devin Booker fifth. So, I mean, even other teams that lean really heavily on one guy are not nearly doing it to the level that Dallas is. I mean, it's going to come down to Doncic's health. I think if he looks more like the guy he was in games one and two and for most of game three, I think they have a chance. If he doesn't, I think this probably ends in six games. Has your opinion on the Clippers in terms of them being a longer term contender in the Western Conference, you know, second round and beyond, has that changed at all over the last two games? Because as you start to look at, you know, what's going on with the Lakers, we still don't really know for sure if Anthony Davis is out tonight, but it seems like that's going to be the case. I mean, pretty good chance that they'll go down 3-2 in that series without AD. If we're looking at a playoffs without the LA Clippers or without the LA Lakers, and you know, I think a team like Utah, team like Phoenix, those are not exactly, you know, teams that have been here year in and year out and are the type of teams that you would fear. Like, I think there's an argument to be made that suddenly after being down 0-2, if the Clippers can close out the Mavs, there's an argument that having Kawhi Leonard maybe makes them the favorite all of a sudden in the Western Conference, which based on where we were a week ago, does seem kind of backwards.
Yeah, I think if they close it out in convincing fashion, I think that becomes the case. If this somehow kind of stumbles into a game seven and they almost let it slip away like again, that I think that the Clippers, Jazz, and Phoenix will be relatively even, especially if Chris Paul's shoulder looks better. If Chris Paul's shoulder still looks bad, then it's kind of like I think it's kind of a wrap for them, so we'll see about that. But if a sports book put them as the favorite to come out of the West after the series, yeah, like you mentioned, that would not be shocking.
They were my pick to come out of the West before the playoffs started, and then I just felt like an idiot about that pick after those first two games because they just looked so pathetic at times. But I think I would I'd probably favor them ever so slightly over the Suns and the Jazz. You know, I mean, I think it's tough to have much faith in the Lakers at this point, but I think those other teams will introduce some new variables and be able to take advantage of some things about the Clippers that this Mavs team can't really exploit. So I just think we're in for a really, really entertaining next couple rounds in the Western Conference, because all these teams can sort of talk themselves into having a shot. I mean, I don't think the Nuggets or the Blazers have a shot, but I know that those teams might think they do. And certainly the Clippers, Jazz, and Suns, like I wouldn't say that either of those teams should be more than like a, you know, 30%, 40% favorite to come out of the conference.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I mean, the regular season would imply that Utah and Phoenix, I think, are the favorites, but the history of NBA playoffs suggests that the team that has the best player, even if that team has, you know, underperformed at times in the playoffs or during the regular season, like that's the team you want to bet on. Like straight up, we'd be looking at Utah and the Clippers in round two. I would have a very tough time picking against Kawhi Leonard in that series, even though Utah has been the better team wire to wire.
Yeah, I mean, especially since the Jazz, kind of their weakness is that they don't have great wing defenders. Like, they have Royce O'Neal, but he's not going to shut down Kawhi Leonard, and Bogdanović isn't really going to, you know, like, you. Mitchell is fine, and Bogdanović is fine. I'm not sure Mitchell's an elite defender. Yeah, I mean, just having those two, the Jazz and the Clippers, in this scenario face each other makes me wonder if the sports books will just end up, like, Phoenix being the favorite to come out of the West, just because they don't have to go through, you know, they're going to have to go through Denver or Portland, and they'll presumably win that. So I think that would end up being the case.
Yeah, I think that's a really good call. Like, if Chris Paul, by the end of this series, assuming the Suns hold on and win it, like if Chris Paul looks like he's playing at 100%, I mean, I just think that Clippers Jazz series would go probably at least six, whereas the Suns would just be heavy favorites against either of those two teams. Mm-hmm. And I would be, I mean, I don't think the Jazz could stop like Kawhi specifically at all. Like, I think he could kind of do whatever he wants against them, but I also just don't know what they do with Rudy Gobert, because all of their best lineups or most scary lineups don't really include Zubac. And even if Zubac is out there, I don't really know how good he would be at slowing Gobert down. I guess their best bet would be to kind of pressure up hard enough on the Jazz guards and kind of prevent them from working that pick and roll. But I mean, I think that would be a fascinating clash of styles.
So let me read you the NBA title odds right now. And keep in mind that these are slanted, you know, in favor of teams that have either already closed out their first round series or are in good position to do so. The Nets are our favorites at plus 180. Then the Jazz at 4-1. The Bucks at plus 550. The Lakers 6-1. Clippers 7-1. Sixers 9-1. Suns 15-1. And then you got a big drop off down to Denver at 40-1. So obviously the Jazz get a little bit of a boost for being up 3-1, whereas the Clippers, you know, could still very well lose the series to Dallas. But I do think the main point I'm trying to make here is I think this is all shaping up very well for the Eastern Conference. You know, whichever team emerges from Milwaukee, Brooklyn in round two, we'll see what happens with the Sixers, who I think will take care of the Wizards, even if Embiid ends up missing a game or two. If he's healthy, they're obviously in this as well. But would you take let's assume that the Lakers end up losing to the Suns, and we'll get to the Lakers in a second. But if the Lakers are out of this and all of a sudden it's, you know, Clippers, Mavs, one of those two, plus Utah, and then the winner of Denver, Portland, would you take any of those teams up against Philly, Milwaukee, or Brooklyn?
I mean, I think the Clippers, I feel like the Clippers and Jazz maybe could give the Bucks some trouble. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't. That's tough. I still think the Nets are winning the title. So that's how I would lean, I guess, against anything. But yeah, I'm not sure. What do you think, James?
I think whoever wins the Nets Bucks series is going to win the finals, barring some injury to one of their key players. So I think that I mean, the Bucks. Yeah, the Bucks have looked. I think the Suns got the Bucks in the regular season in pretty impressive fashion down the stretch. But I think that it's kind of a different class. Those top. I'm not really taking the Sixers that seriously, just because I think they're built more for the regular season than the playoffs, given the.
If you're a basketball junkie, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Twice a week, JJ Redick is cooking on his podcast, The Old Man and the Three. He has guys come on in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, including Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron in Miami, and the moment Tyrese Halliburton knew Pascal Siakam would be a good fit in Indy. In addition to player interviews, every Monday, JJ breaks down the top three things happening around the NBA with unmatched analysis, not outlandish takes, and is often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler to dive deep on rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? You won't find another outlet that covers the game as comprehensively and with such insight as JJ does it on The Old Man and the Three. Make this your companion podcast during the playoffs. Listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ben Simmons factor and that type of stuff. But, I mean, the Nets and the Bucks to me just seem like they're playing a tier above in terms of the quality of play that they have versus the rest of the league right now.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think, you know, the Sixers still give those teams a decent run. I don't think that's a sweep or anything in the conference finals. But with the way that the West is kind of cannibalizing, you know, each other, I think the winner of that series probably ends up winning the title. On the Lakers front, the Lakers are in huge trouble. They weren't playing that well before Anthony Davis went down. Likely not going to have him for game five tonight. We'll see what happens in that one. Even if Davis comes back for game six, or even if he plays in game five, like I don't know that we're going to see him at full strength at any point for the rest of the series. And as Anthony Davis's health declines, Chris Paul's health seems to be incrementally getting better as the series goes on. I don't think I'm ready to write the Lakers off whatsoever. They opened, I think, as 5.5-point dogs tonight. That number has shrunk down to 5 as of a couple hours ago. I have no idea what's going to happen in that game. And again, I don't want to break down a game that is about to, you know, tip off in a few hours here. But how do you see, you know, at large, the rest of the series playing out, starting with kind of a general prediction for tonight and then, you know, whatever happens in game six or if we get to a game seven?
I mean, I think the Suns are in the driver's seat here with Anthony Davis. I mean, Davis has already has pretty big stretches of being a passive player when he's 100% healthy. And if he's got, you know, I mean, the injury he's dealing right now is an injured groin. He hyperextended his knee. He is still presumably, you know, dealing with some like calf and Achilles soreness from like before the playoffs. And you know, like you mentioned, like Chris Paul's health is going the other direction. Like he looks great last game, or at least better. And I mean, without Davis, like I just don't know what they're going to do. Like do you go Markieff Morris? Do you try more Kuzma? Kuzma's been awful, by the way. LeBron is the only person on the team that you're like actually scared of even a little bit. Like Schroeder might be able to score 20 points just, you know, by pure attempts, but without Davis, I mean, Phoenix is really in the driver's seat.
Yeah, I would echo all of that. I think it's just becoming clearer and clearer that this is a pretty flawed roster that would have required elite performances from both LeBron and Anthony Davis to make a deep run. So I almost feel like this Davis injury is just going to end up being kind of a convenient excuse for the Lakers. Because I think that they would have been disappointed or just gotten upset at some point here. If it wasn't going to be the Suns this round, I just don't think they had the supporting cast to make a deep run.
I think that's 100% true. I it's very easy to see that narrative emerging, you know, especially if it's a lopsided loss in game five. And then, you know, maybe that carries over to six or seven. I do think if they can make it through this series, you know, they are fairly well positioned to maybe bounce back just because of, you know, the matchup that would be awaiting them in round two, which would presumably be easier than this one. And obviously, in that case, you're expecting both Davis and LeBron to be healthier. So if they could find a way to navigate out of this series, I don't think it's over. But at the same time, I feel a little foolish for thinking that this roster was, you know, dramatically better than last year's, which admittedly was pretty flawed. You know, a lot of the issues that the Lakers have on this roster were there last year. But like you said, you know, this roster requires elite, elite play from LeBron and Davis. They got that in the finals last year in the bubble, and it worked out okay. They win the title. Now, I think they lucked out with the team that they faced in the finals in Miami. You know, that was banged up. I think that contributed to it. But at the same time, you know, this team is essentially a slightly better version on paper of the one that won the title last year. So it's hard for me to say that, you know, this roster was just slopped together and it was never that good, because I definitely thought it was good at points this year. But man, Schroeder has just been, you know, he hasn't been the guy that he was in OKC last year. I mean, Marc Gasol, I think expectations should have been relatively low for him at this age. Same goes for guys like Wes Matthews, but they weirdly miss Dwight Howard. And then the biggest thing that I've been saying to you over and over, James, you've kind of acted as my personal Lakers counselor via Slack these last couple of weeks, but there's no shooting on this roster at all. Like, Kyle Korver is not retired. How is Kyle Korver not on the Lakers roster? Like, Ben McLemore is getting minutes for this team. Like, that is the kind of dire straits that the Lakers are in right now. And even when Davis is healthy, you know, they haven't been a great scoring team. You know, the defense has kind of been bailing them out all along for the last season and a half. And then without Davis, as we saw in the second half on Sunday, like, if LeBron's not, you know, doing everything he can to create shots for everyone else, they have no options whatsoever on offense.
Yeah, I mean, basically the only guy on that team who has any sort of a case as a plus three-point shooter and a plus defender is maybe KCP. Like,
maybe, and he hasn't been a plus shooter in this series.
Yeah, exactly. And like, maybe Wes Matthews. Like I honestly think Wes Matthews is one of their four, like, at full health. Like, I think he, like, is in their best lineup at this point, just because they've got so many guys on this team who either can't defend or can't shoot. And the guys who can defend, like Caruso, can't shoot. And I mean, like, Kuzma, Drummond, Harrell, you can't keep playing these guys in the high leverage playoff situation. Mm-hmm. You just can't.
Well, when you're talking about a potential, sorry, Alex, when you're talking about a potential Davis replacement for game five, it's not like you have a Bertans type, like somebody where you're like, look, let's just cross our fingers and, you know, hopefully he gets hot and hits five threes. It's like your options are either someone, you know, you're playing Drummond, you know, significantly more than you want to. Like, that's going to probably end up hurting you in the long run. You have a guy in Harrell who can really only score within 3 feet. You know, if you feed more minutes to Kuzma, who's shooting like 15% from the field in the series, that, you know, that feels like a fool's errand. Markieff Morris, you mentioned, I mean, not a dependable shooter whatsoever. There's a reason he's out of the rotation essentially when the Lakers are at full strength. Like, it's not like this team was the 2011 Heat, where you go all in on three guys and you just have to bargain bin the rest of the roster. Like, this was a handpicked roster around LeBron James. And obviously he has, you know, he bears some responsibility here. I'm sure every single move that the Lakers make is at least run by LeBron James. I don't know if it's just a career long, like, blind spot that he's had as far as the type of guys that he needs around him, or if it's the front office that made these decisions, but the Lakers at full strength, when things are going well, they look like the best team in the league. But when you subtract even some of the minor pieces, like, this roster just crumbles so quickly.
Yeah. And they, you know, even aside, like, they are getting annihilated in the minutes LeBron doesn't play. Like, they can't not play LeBron. This is going to come down to, I wouldn't be shocked if he plays like 45 minutes in this game or something insane, because they, per 100 possessions, LeBron is plus 56 when he's on the court. Like, that's like incomprehensibly, like, he has to be out there. They just get destroyed. And like you mentioned, you know, even the guys who are supposed to be good at, you know, 3 and D, like, I mean, KCP's hurt. Caruso, like, there's no reason he should be like fourth on the team in minutes in a series that they're like desperate in. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think Frank Vogel honestly deserves a ton of credit for his regular season coaching to have even gotten them to this point. Like, they, when LeBron and AD weren't healthy, the fact that they kept their head above water at all is just really kind of remarkable when you start to see all these flaws open up. And I really just don't see them going on a deep run, even if AD were to get fully healthy, but especially with the current state of things. And I think it's just going to make for fascinating sort of theater to see what happens in the offseason of this roster.
I think the question for the rest of this series, you mentioned, Alex, you know, it might take a LeBron 45 minute type of game. I'm thinking back to that 2018 Boston series when, you know, they were basically on the ropes the entire time and LeBron, you know, had to do everything. The question is, can he still do that? And 2018 LeBron, especially at that point, you know, where he, I think he had at like halfway through that season, he just accepted like, this is how it's going to have to go. And, you know, was able to will that team all the way to the finals. This roster isn't quite as bleak as that one was, but does he still have that in him at this point? And based on what we've seen through these first four games, I think it's possible, but I don't think I would count on it in the way that you could in previous seasons.
No, I mean, there are points. I feel like in the most recent games, he's looked a little better. Like it seems like he's more comfortable driving to the rim. He's more aggressive. I thought in especially the first game that he was like hilariously passive. But yeah, I mean, I think maybe he still has it in him. I think we're going to see him try at least. And you know, just kind of like see what he can accomplish. But again, when there are no other threats, you know, around him, like Phoenix is going to do what teams have been doing to Giannis, where they're just going to put up the wall. I think when LeBron drives, and like, he's still a great athlete, but he's not the kind of like rise above three players athlete anymore, like, and dunk it. He just doesn't do that. He can't. So I think it's going to be, I'm worried about this game for them. I think it could go really badly.
Yeah, I think so too. In these games, LeBron, I think he has a tendency to try to work his way from the outside in, like attempting a lot of threes early on. And if that's not working, things could really go south. I do feel like there's an argument to be made that the Lakers are due for a better shooting game, but we also just went over the fact that none of these guys are actually good shooters. So is it really realistic to expect Kyle Kuzma, after going like 1 of 15 from three, to suddenly go 6 of 9? Like, I don't know if any of those guys really have that in them. Like, the guys that are struggling probably should be struggling. You know, it's not like you have a 45% 3-point shooter who's just like dying to break out of a slump. You have like below average 3-point shooters who are just shooting even more below average.
Yeah, I mean, they made the sixth fewest threes in the regular season.
They're not, I mean, these guys just aren't good. I don't know what, like, Waylon, can you tell me what the hell happened to Kyle Kuzma's offensive game? Because it's just like, he
cannot.
Like, the things he was good at 5 years ago are now his like biggest weaknesses. Like, it's just so, it's so bizarre.
Yeah, I have no answer for it. I mean, I've watched a ton of Lakers games this year, and even when LeBron and Davis were out, like, right away, like early April, or even late March, you know, Kuzma had a string of games where he went like 25, 21, and like 30 points, you know, I think in the span of five games. And then after that, it was just kind of back to the same old guy, where it's alternating, you know, 15-point night with an 8-point night, and then a 25-point night and 4 points the next night. And that's just kind of been how it's rolling, you know, through the end of the regular season, now into the playoffs. I mean, he, over his last seven games dating back to the play-in plus the final two regular season games, which were important games for the Lakers, so these weren't throwaways by any means, 22.9 minutes per game, 5.9 points per game, 33% shooting, 20% from three. And he had four of those seven games, 0 3-pointers made. I mean, this roster was constructed very heavily to skew towards LeBron and Davis, obviously. And, you know, if you're going to build it like that, you need at least one guy, or probably two to three guys in the playoffs every single night to at least give you an average game. And that's the problem. It's like, if Dennis Schroeder or Kyle Kuzma play even average basketball, the Lakers are probably up 3-1 in the series, because, you know, one of the hidden secrets here is that the Suns are shooting even worse from three than the Lakers are on a percentage basis. So it's not like, you know, the Suns are just red hot and the Lakers can't hit anything. Like, the Lakers defense has been there. It's been more than good enough for them to win all of these games so far, but the offense has just been that bad.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of wonder, like, is there a big Devin Booker game coming here? Like in a, tonight or maybe in game six. Cause I mean, you're totally right. The Suns could very easily not have a 2-2 tie in this series just based on how they've shot the ball.
Yeah, because we haven't gotten, like, the Devin Booker game yet, right? Which is kind of what I was expecting. And it could just, like you mentioned, it could just so happen that it comes during the game that the Lakers need LeBron to do the most, too. Especially since, you know, when they don't have Anthony Davis out there, it's even hard, like, The Lakers, they trap Devin Booker a lot, right? They're like, make sure, like, that is the guy who we cannot have go for 35 points. And when Davis isn't out there, that trapping, it doesn't work as well. Because if you send Davis to trap, like, he's hard to pass around. You're not going to shoot over him. If you let him sit back and watch the rim, like, that's fine too. But without him there, is Kyle Kuzma going to be trapping? Is he going to be protecting the rim? Like, how much do you trust Drummond? I think it's going to be... This is just as big for the Lakers on defense as it is on offense.
What's up, guys? Are you looking for a new contest to play during the 2021 NBA playoffs? If so, try Fantasy Five's new free-to-play NBA contest. It's simple. All you have to do is pick one player to beat their fantasy point target from each of the five games. If all your picks are correct, you can win a share of the $5,000 jackpot. Other guaranteed prizes are also available if you finish atop the weekly leaderboard, including an official NBA kit. Make the NBA postseason more interesting. Go to fantasy5.com today. That's fantasy, the number 5.com to enter your picks today. Let's go back to the East and talk Hawks-Knicks. This has been the Julius Randle series for negative reasons, unfortunately. He's at 16.8 points, 11.3 boards, 4.3 assists, 27% shooting so far through four games in this series. He did look a little bit better in game four relative to the first three games, but he just can't get really anywhere right now. A lot of extremely contested looks, you know, not getting to the rim, not getting to the foul line at nearly the rate that he was during the regular season. And you know, I've read this and heard this brought up by a number of people, but I think the really obvious point with this Knicks team is they kind of hit their peak during the regular season. And when you're playing guys like Randle and Barrett, like 38, 39 minutes every single night, you know, Reggie Bullock was even playing minutes like that for a lot of the year. You know, a lot of other teams have another scheme or another lineup or another gear they can go to. And it feels like the Knicks have just not really changed anything. And they're kind of out of answers at this point. And it feels like this one's going to wrap up probably in five, maybe in six. They do have game five at home, at least.
It's been good for my sanity that this series is going this way, because like when you just look at these two rosters, the Hawks have just so much more talent, especially offensively. Like it's just not even close. Like you have guys like the guys playing like the fourth, fifth, sixth best player role for the Knicks wouldn't be in most playoff rotations, I don't think. And I guess you could say that that's a testament to Tom Thibodeau during the regular season, but I thought it was comical how much love Julius Randle was getting on like there was MVP ballot talk and second team All-NBA talk, and like just look at him now. Like look at what's happening when the stakes are high, when teams are able to game plan for him, and like tell me how many players in the NBA you wouldn't take over Julius Randle.
Yeah, it's been kind of rough to watch lately. I mean, like it's because the staples of the team were Randle and Barrett, who are both getting exposed in a huge way. Now, I wasn't expecting as much from Barrett as I was from Randle, especially since Randle played so well against the Hawks during the regular season. Like that was kind of that was the thing people kept bringing up was like, well, you know, the Knicks clearly don't have the talent. You know, like 8-9 deep to match up with Atlanta, but Julius Randle, you know, maybe he's going to score 30 a game. It's like it's been Derrick Rose, 23 a game. Very like odd series. They don't have the personnel to like just abuse Trae Young. They're just kind of being overwhelmed right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the narrative that like Trae Young is breaking out or reaching some new level in this series is off base. I think this is just how good he's played for most of the season. And like you said, Alex, this is a pretty juicy matchup for him because the Knicks just can't really punish him on defense the way that, that some of the elite teams can. But, I mean, this is just an outclassing. I mean, they're making like Nate McMillan look like some X's and O's whiz in this series. So, I mean, it's been pretty comical. And I mean, there were a ton of people picked the Knicks to win this series. I don't really understand it.
Yeah, on paper, the Hawks are by far the more talented team. And I think we're seeing, too, that how big of a difference Bogdanović makes. And obviously, that was the case for the last 20, 25 games of the regular season once he came back from injury. But, man, he is unbelievable to have as, like, I guess, kind of their second option at this point. It's been such a weird year for John Collins. But he seems to be, like, more confident that he's the number two guy behind Trey. But, if you're alternating between those guys as your two and three and you have Capella, DeAndre Hunter's back, like, I mean, this Hawks team is actually pretty damn good. I wouldn't pick them to get out of round two against Philly. But I think part of it, too, is, I mean, are the Knicks like the worst four seed in a really long time in either conference? You know, like if Miami is the four playing Atlanta, I think the narratives for all three teams are just completely different.
Yeah, I mean, I still might have picked Atlanta over Miami just because I'm a believer in the Hawks. But yeah, I think there would have been a lot of expectations definitely would have been different. Assuming they win the series, I think they'll give the 76ers a pretty good run. I wouldn't be surprised if it went to six games, especially, I mean, we don't know 100% what's going on with Joel Embiid's health. He's doubtful for game five. But I think they have I think their on paper talent is great. They probably need a couple players to overperform, but you know, Capella isn't going to like be a pushover to Embiid. And I think the key for the 76ers will end up being like, you know, can Ben Simmons reliably guard Trae Young all game?
I'm really kind of looking forward to that series, to be honest. Like, I think Doc Rivers has lost series where he's had the team that's been about as heavily favored as that Sixers team is going to be against the Hawks. And if Rick Carlisle was the Hawks coach or Eric Spoelstra was the Hawks coach or something like that, I actually might pick them. Nate McMillan hasn't won a series like this before in his career. I mean, that doesn't mean he can't do it, but I think the Sixers are one of those teams where they're kind of ripe for a playoff upset if they run into the wrong team, because they have these flaws that you can exploit pretty easily if you have enough talent. So I'm really looking forward to that series.
That series becomes very interesting if Embiid is hobbled. You know, even if he's back to like 80-85%. For game one of that series, which is very realistic. I mean, it's quite possible that he's 100%. And then in that case, you know, Philly's going to go in as a heavy favorite. But yeah, the overall talent disparity, obviously Embiid is the best player of the series by a good margin. But beyond that, it's not that heavily slanted in favor of Philly. And like you said, that team has some very glaring flaws that a good coaching staff should be able to take advantage of. And Alex, you mentioned Ben Simmons on Trae Young. I mean, you also have the Matisse Thybulle card to play. If you need to throw Thybulle out there for 30 minutes a night because Simmons, you know, you need him elsewhere, or he's too big to guard Trae Young, wherever it is. I mean, you have two really, really good and two very different options to throw at Trae Young to kind of frustrate him throughout that series.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with Thybulle is that he can't play offense. Right? So, like, he was 25% from three in the regular season. He's 23% from three in four playoff games where he's playing real minutes and taking even more threes than he was in the regular season. So it's like they can't have Ben Simmons and Matisse Thybulle out there at the same time, which, you know, they usually don't do anyway. But I would expect them to basically just, you know, when Ben Simmons comes out and he's done guarding Trae Young, put Thybulle in, have him guard Trae Young, do it like that. I don't know. I mean, they could try to play it differently. You know, maybe have like Danny Green shadow Trae Young, but I don't think he can do that kind of a thing anymore. Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited for that, for this series, assuming it's going to happen. I hope to watch every game.
I kind of think the Sixers will lose the Thibault minutes, though, because it gives the Hawks – like, I think you have to have Trae Young out there whenever Thibault's out there just for hiding Trae Young defensively. Like, if you're able to just put Trae Young on Matisse Thibault, that's the same thing as putting him on Reggie Bullock in this series. And I think if you have Bogdanovich out there or even, like, Lou Williams, then Young can get – the ball to those guys when he's getting pressured up by Thibault or if he's getting double teamed or whatever, and then you're kind of playing downhill. So I mean, it's gonna, like, Doc Rivers is really gonna have to have a good plan. I mean, I think that series probably goes 6, maybe 7.
I think having him on Thibault is even more advantageous than Bullock, because at least with Bullock, like, you still need to close out on him. Like, you're not really worried about Reggie Bullock taking you off the dribble and getting all the way to the rim or even making a pass. Yeah. Like, but you have to respect him as a catch and shoot guy. I mean, he's one of the big reasons they were able to even take a game in the series. But I mean, with Thibault, I wouldn't be surprised if they do have Trae Young hiding on him. Like, are you even bothering closing out? Like, you're probably encouraging Thibault to shoot until he knocks down one or two from the corner.
Yeah. 100%. He's a 23.3 point shooter. Like, he just, he doesn't have him.
He's one of those guys. Like, and the Sixers have a few of those guys that are part of their most commonly used lineup. So, I mean, I think they might have to run some pick and roll with Tobias Harris, like a lot of Tobias Harris pick and roll or something. Like, I don't really know exactly what they're going to do, but I mean, if Embiid's healthy, he will absolutely eat. So, like, we have to mention that, like, the Hawks don't have anyone that's strong enough to guard him. I mean, Capella's awesome defensively, but he's not awesome in that specific kind of way. So, I mean, Embiid is just going to average, he might average over a point per minute in that series.
I want to go back to Randle real quickly. And obviously his struggles have been the main storyline on the Knicks side of things. And this is legitimately, like, one of the worst playoff series we've ever seen. And it is worth noting that if he has, like, a really good game five, that maybe takes him out of the club that I'm about to put him in. But the players to shoot under 30% on 15 plus field goal attempts per game in a playoff series, that list is not long. In the last 40 years, it's Julius Randle. Ironically enough, it's Jimmy Butler also this year. It's Vince Carter in 2000, Kevin Johnson in 97, and Cliff Robinson in 93. And then there's a big drop off where it's like 20 years, nobody even did it. And then a bunch of guys did it in like the 40s and 50s when it was like really good to be shooting 38% from the field. But like it's the numbers are as bad as it's looked watching it on TV. Like it is hard to take that many shots and be that inefficient. My question is, does this ultimately negate one of the more memorable regular season efforts that we've seen, just in terms of kind of coming out of nowhere and being the guy for a premier franchise and turning this into like a really fun year for the Knicks? I think a lot of people are going to get clowned for putting him on their MVP ballot, putting him on second team all NBA. And I totally get that there's a lot of revisionism that ends up being done when, you know, a player has a nice regular season and then, you know, is eliminated in round one. But, you know, does that hold up? Like, does having a bad playoff series mean that he shouldn't be on an all NBA team?
I mean, I don't think he should have been. Like, everything I'm saying, I would have said before this series. And I just think that this is kind of confirming that. Like, I just think if he was doing this for, like, I don't know, like the Grizzlies or something, and they had been just as big of overachievers, I just don't think there's any chance he would be in these conversations. And like, you know, him versus, well, like for instance, him versus Jimmy Butler, who you just mentioned, like give me Jimmy Butler over him on a second team all NBA all day, every day. And they both had terrible playoffs, but like we've seen Jimmy Butler do this, like reach a very high level in the past, and he impacts the game on both sides of the ball. And like Julius Randle, like this was, I mean, this is probably gonna be one of the more memorable, just random out of nowhere seasons by a player. And I definitely don't begrudge him for winning most improved player, because I think he had a very solid case there. But like the idea of him being more valuable than like Damian Lillard, or him being more valuable than even LeBron playing half a season. Like that's just not even close to me. Like, so I think that people just really got swept up in this just because it was the Knicks and just because it was surprising. But I mean, maybe there's not a terrible case for him on the third team, but the idea of him being on the second team over like someone like Paul George or something, or over Jimmy Butler, or I mean, even like look at what Jason Tatum's doing for the Celtics. Like, does anyone seriously think that Julius Randle's better than Jason Tatum? And did he really have that much better of a regular season than Jason Tatum? Like, I just don't really think that there's much case for that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much on board with what James is saying. I think you can't like start. I don't know if you can say necessarily, I'm not going to vote for this guy because I don't think he'll play well in his like first playoff series ever. I think next year he'll probably get dinged for this, you know, kind of like Giannis got dinged this year, MVP wise. Not that he deserved to win MVP this year, but just, you know, the narrative coming out, how poor the Bucks played in the playoffs last year kind of took Giannis out of the conversation because people kind of had voter regret. I think the same thing could happen to Randall moving forward. And some of this too, yeah, I mean, big market plays a factor. I think people overvaluing defensive rebounds always plays a factor in some conversations like this.
And his like the pace and like usage stuff, like it just by default being the only guy that could do anything offensively really on this team, and just the landscape we're in, like his numbers just kind of look better.
Well, 38 minutes a game too. I mean,
right.
Yeah, you're comparing his numbers to someone like Giannis, who's playing, you know, 34, 33 minutes a game. Like,
and my comparison, I think I've said this to you, Nick, is like, I think this is going to look a lot like that Pascal Siakam second team from 2019, where like the guy just never comes close to really reaching those heights again. And it's just sort of just a really fluky one.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. The big market is probably the biggest factor here, because even without fans, it really felt like the Knicks becoming relevant. And especially over the last few weeks of the year, when it became clear that they were going to be a playoff team, like it felt like that's when, you know, things really took off. And it's like this guy, you know, is there. Did you see like the Patrick Ewing Photoshop of like that famous photo of Ewing, like with the outstretched arms looking to the crowd, like somebody Photoshopped Randall into that, like things were completely off the rails at that point. I don't know. Like, I think the Siakam comparison is really good. I do think at the time, like, even though they're not that dissimilar in age, you know, Siakam had a couple years where he just wasn't really relevant, and Randall obviously came in at a young age. Like with Siakam, it felt like there was like this road to like infinite ascent, you know, after he had that great year, and he's kind of topped off a little bit. Whereas with Randall, like I don't see this trajectory really continuing. You know, like after like with Siakam, even though he went down a notch a little bit in the playoffs, it was like, is this guy going to be like a top 10 player in the league in a year or two? And with Randall, like, I feel like unless maybe you're a diehard Knicks fan, is anybody expecting Randall to play better next year? Like, I think when we go through and do our projections in a few months, there's no way we're just going to pencil him in for the same numbers as this past year.
No, probably not. I mean, the minutes matter. You know, I think the 3-point shooting, is going to play a factor. Same with his free throw shooting, both went up, but
yeah,
I think some people have voter regret, but I don't blame the people who voted for him third team All NBA. No. He did have a great season. So it was a great story. You know, when we look back,
well, and a big part of his case is that he played every game, and a lot of the guys that we're comparing him to missed 10, 15, 20, you know, 20 plus games in a lot of it. So like every single player in the league played 72 games, he probably doesn't make an All-NBA team. But a lot of factors kind of came together to make that happen.
And next year you're going to have, I mean, it was a perfect storm. And I don't, third team is totally fine. And I don't really care that much about this stuff. But just even at the time when, like, Bill Simmons is saying he voted Julius Randle fifth for MVP, like, that's just so ludicrous to me. Like, when you consider how many players are better than Julius Randle, like, it's just like, and there's a player better than Julius Randle in this very series. His name's Trae Young. And he was like, there are a lot of stats that would tell you Trae Young had a better regular season than Julius Randle. And he had no chance of getting that type of recognition given the market he plays.
Do you guys have any Grizzlies Jazz thoughts before we finish out with a mini preview of Bucks Nets in round two?
No, like, takes other than I just love the Grizzlies. Like, I didn't watch that much of them during the season, but like I think I've watched every game. Maybe I've missed one playoff game since their final regular season game against the Warriors. The more I watch them, the more I love watching them play, man. They're such a fun team.
I guess one take, I don't even think it's probably that controversial, and the Grizzlies probably wouldn't even disagree with me, but I think they would have a better chance if they dialed back Jaren Jackson's minutes by quite a bit just in this series. And if their whole goal in this series was like, how can we possibly win this series or push this series to six games? Like, the Jaren Jackson, when Jackson and Morant are out there together defensively, it's just really tough. And Kyle Anderson, I love this kind of bounce back Kyle Anderson year. It's just been like, he's always been sort of one of my like low key favorite players, and he's just been so good at times in this series, defensively and in the playing games. Like, I think Desmond Bane has a really bright future. Xavier Tillman, obviously, like, you know, he's not going to be a star or anything, but I mean, they just have so many guys who they really did a nice job of finding and identifying in the draft and free agency.
I'm with you on Jackson. That was the only note I had under this one, other than Brandon Clark being completely out of the rotation, which is a less than encouraging development, considering where it looked like he might be after his rookie year. But he has not played in three of the four games and really only got in garbage time in game three. But watching Jaren Jackson last night, like, all he's trying to do is shoot threes. It's a little, his game is a little Porzingis-ish, and we always knew he wasn't a great rebounder. Like, the blocks numbers look okay. I think on aggregate, he's a better defender than Porzingis. I liked what he was doing in help. He was really good along the baseline, kind of trying to force guys into tough passes, and that worked out a few times in game four. But he's just not really very diverse offensively. And you know, he hasn't played a lot over the last couple of years, and I'm sure that's a factor. But like, the trajectory that we thought he was on a year and a half ago, to me, is not quite as bright right now as it looked like back then.
That Porzingis comp just killed me. Because I think you're right, potentially.
All he's trying to do is shoot threes. He's just running three-point line to three-point line and like doing those, that kind of ridiculous push shot. And like, I don't know. I don't like it.
I think he'll be I think he's a nice sort of buy low. Like, I think this is just like asking too much for him to come back after all that missed time and be ready to compete in a series like this. Like, I mean, he already had some of these flaws before the injury. I mean, he's like a foul machine and just not really physical, but I think give him an off season, like, hopefully he's able to stay healthy and everything. Like, I think he's got a chance to really turn some heads next year.
Right. And they need him to. I mean, they can add to this team. And when you have a guy like Morant, you know, you're always going to be somewhat in it, at least in terms of being an intriguing team, but he's the only other like really high upside piece on this team. Like, I think they found a guy in Des Bane who's maybe like your fourth or fifth option long term, maybe even better as like a sixth man. De'Anthony Melton, I thought, was pretty good in game four. You know, we touched on Clark, who I think looked like a future piece. We'll see what happens with him. But I mean, if this team is going to be good enough to kind of hang around and be like the 12th to 16th best team every year, they might have trouble landing another guy. And I think they're really kind of banking on Jackson being that long term number two.
Yeah, and Dylan Brooks is kind of sneaky old. He's 25 already. Not that that's like old, but he's already been in the league for 4 years. It's just, and again, he's a guy who I think ideally is like your fourth guy. You know, like the role he's playing in this playoffs, like, I mean, he's doing amazing. I'm just not sure. I don't know. I mean, are you expecting 26 points a game in the playoffs from Dylan Brooks, like, for the rest of his career? Like,
yes.
I don't think so.
I never thought I would think that Dylan Brooks could look as good on a guy like Stephen Curry as he did defensively.
Oh, yeah. Right. Like, that's the biggest surprise of all, right? James, like, I was telling Alex last week, like, I don't know if there's a player that, like, pound for pound, we have slandered over the years more than Dylan Brooks. Like, this is shocking what's happened to him in terms of his arc. Like, I thought he'd be out of the league within 2 years.
Watching him in college and thinking of him coming in or developing into this, like, crazy defensive stopper, like, That's just so outrageous.
I remember at the combine that he was like the only guy that measured in with a shorter wingspan than his height. And that was the final nail in the coffin for me. I'm like, he's not even going to get drafted. And now here we are. Like, it's one thing for him to have these scoring explosions because he kind of showed that in college. Like, he was a gunner. And when he ran hot, he was really hot and nobody could stop him. But like, for him to be a plus defender on a guy like Steph Curry, it makes absolutely no sense to me. All right, let's finish out with Nets Bucks. We're being a little presumptuous, assuming that Brooklyn will make round two, but I think we can all agree that that's likely going to be the case. No Dante DiVincenzo for Milwaukee. Jeff Green probably going to miss maybe a game or two to begin this series. I don't know if that's exactly a wash, but you know, both fairly key contributors for these teams. I just want to ask initially, what is your feeling right now, regardless of how the rest of Nets Celtics goes in round one? Which team, how many games, like what is your initial lean as you start to dig in?
My initial lean is Nets in seven. I think I've been pretty consistent about that. But I think I also think the DiVincenzo for Jeff Green thing, like I love DiVincenzo. He has not been a good playoff player in his first 2 years in the NBA. And I think there are just a lot of things that I don't know. Bryn Forbes might end up being better in a lot of minutes than more DiVincenzo, even though the defense for DiVincenzo is better. My initial lean is Nets in seven.
I don't know if I'm qualified to give an unbiased prediction here, but I disagree with Alex a little bit about the magnitude of the DiVincenzo injury. And it's not even like I don't disagree with what he said about DiVincenzo in the playoffs. I just don't. I think it's a lot easier for Bryn Forbes and Pat Connaughton to look good when they are your sixth, seventh, eighth men than when you're relying on those guys to play both right. ends of the court in extremely high leverage minutes. And I just think, like Bryn, like this is just a really, really tough matchup for Bryn Forbes specifically, but also for Pat Connaughton, just because like all three of those guys on the Nets are just going to hunt Forbes mercilessly in pick and rolls and just find ways to make the Bucks pay for having him out there. I mean, like Kyrie can even just take Bryn Forbes into the post and do work. Like, I think they're just going to, I think they're really going to light him up. Like, he's going to have to be shooting as well as he was in that Heat series to not be just a huge net negative when he's out there. And he could do that. I mean, like, it's not like I don't necessarily think the Nets are going to shut Forbes down on the other end. So it's possible, but it's just the bar for him offensively to deserve the type of run he's going to get is going to be really high. And then Pat Connaughton, like, I was telling you earlier today, Nick, I think this series might weirdly hinge on how well Pat Connaughton shoots from three. Like, if he, like, I think the Bucks win this series if Pat Connaughton shoots like 38% from three. But if he shoots 33%, then it probably goes to the Nets. Cause I think all these games, we should expect all these games to come down to the final few minutes. Like, I think this is just going to be one of the best playoff series we've seen in a long time. And I give the Nets probably the edge in late game situations, but I give the Bucks the edge, especially when they're at home, for like the first 48 minutes of each of these games. And I think it's just going to be imperative for them to build like 5-point cushion, 7-point cushion heading into that final stretch of these games, because I just think they're going to really struggle to stop the Nets in the half court. And I just don't know if they're going to be able to match points with them on the other end. But I think you could definitely say for sure that all three of the Bucks, like Middleton, Holiday, Giannis, are all going to play harder and play better defense this whole series than the big three on the Nets. And I just think it's going to be a really interesting clash, because not only do you have sort of a clash of styles with the kind of intensity and physicality that the Bucks will bring versus what the Nets will bring, but you also have the continuity that the Bucks have versus the lack of continuity the Nets have. And the Bucks have, you know, been fighting for multiple years to kind of break through with this core. largely this core minus Jrue Holiday, and the Nets haven't really. So I just think it's just going to be an all-timer. I guess I'll go Nets in seven as well. I would have probably picked the Bucks if we had a healthy Dante, though.
I'm still on the Nets in the series, but it would have been hard for the Bucks to submit a more convincing round one, right? I mean, for them to look like they did for a lot of game one, pull that out, and then dominate the final three games in that fashion. I mean, I don't think they, you know, they could have like brought more support from me by the way that they played against Miami. Conversely, I mean, the Nets have looked really good when they want to look good, but dropping that game to Boston, you know, kind of letting that one slip away when Boston is, you know, without multiple key pieces, running on fumes, you know, the exact game plan is just get it to Jason Tatum and hopefully he can score. You know, the fact that they found a way to lose that game tells me that maybe they're not 100% locked in. And you would think when the opponent is the Bucks and not the depleted Celtics, you're not going to have to worry about motivation. But look, when two of the three guys you're depending on are, you know, a noted aloof player in Kyrie Irving, and then one of the biggest playoff letdown players in NBA history in James Harden, I don't think it's like 100% given that all of a sudden those guys are just going to lock in and not have these like quarters or halves where they just fall asleep on defense or start getting lazy with passes. And on the other hand of that, I think Milwaukee is going to be fully locked in to this series. I think the fact that they let that one slip away against Miami last year, I think acted as somewhat of a wake-up call, certainly against Miami in round one. And I think just in general, I think they felt like they were the favorites going into the bubble last year. And, you know, as you often see, you need to fail often in spectacular fashion before reaching the ultimate summit. And I still don't know that it's going to happen. I would still pick the Nets just because the top end talent is so overwhelming. But man, the Bucks have looked really good. And even with DiVincenzo out, I do buy into what you said about Forbes, Alex, in terms of, you know, what he brings offensively. Like, my question is, like, how good do we think Dante was on D? Because obviously Forbes is horrific on that end and it's not going to stop anybody. But was DiVincenzo really going to slow down Kyrie that much? Was he really going to slow down Harden that much to the point that having Forbes, you know, a guy who can hit 7 3-pointers, you know, if on any given night, if the minutes are there, like, DiVincenzo is not giving you that kind of offensive upside. So even if you have to run Forbes out there longer than you'd like, the fact that I don't think the Bucks had that great of a chance to slow down those guys individually with Dante, you know, as the one-on-one defender, like it makes me feel a little bit better about having to use Forbes and Connaughton, and we may even see Jeff Teague get dusted off. Who knows?
Okay, I got to jump in really quick. I think Bud cannot play Jeff Teague in this series. Like I don't think he can play him for a single minute.
Okay.
And like, I honestly think that could be the difference in the series. Like if he plays him like 8 minutes a game, I think that could cost the Bucks the series, because I think Teague might be the worst rotation player, if you call him a rotation player, in these playoffs. And that includes the guys on the Knicks. And like they should play Jordan Wara over Jeff Teague if they want to dig into the bench a little bit, because, like, they need to shorten that bench up. I know they lost a guy, but they cannot expand that bench to the point where Jeff Teague is playing minutes in this series.
I agree. I mean, I agree. If you see Jeff Teague walk onto the court, take the Nets money line, live line.
I'm picturing someone listening to this be like, no, that's totally wrong. Like, Jeff Teague has to play in this series.
It could come down to just like tiny things like that, though, you know, like
yeah.
If the Nets could be like plus 28 in 22 minutes that Jeff Teague plays in this series, and that could be the difference.
My like main thought on this series is that this is 3-point shooting versus shooting at the rim, essentially. The Nets obviously are going to be like one of the best 3-point shooting teams you could possibly face. And the Bucks play a lot of the drop coverage. They give up a ton of threes. That's kind of been their Achilles heel on defense. I'm sure they'll try switching more. They've done that before, but I think the Nets will still fire up a ton of threes. And conversely, the Nets' weakness is protecting the rim, which I was surprised at how dominant the Bucks were around the rim against the Heat. I mean, if you can dominate the Heat around the rim like that with Bam Adebayo there, and now you're going up to face the Nets. Yeah, Dwayne Dedman, Udonis Haslam throwing chairs on the sidelines. I think, I mean, Brooke Lopez only took 8 threes in the entire series against the Heat. And I think, you know, using Giannis and Brooke Lopez more like big men in this series is going to be great. And Brooke Lopez got some insanely easy buckets around the rim. I just think it comes down to like who's going to thrive at those two specific places more.
I kind of think Brooke Lopez is the X factor in the series, but I can't decide which way that's going to swing. Like, because he, like you said, Alex, like he should have zero trouble kind of scoring at will and just bullying them down low. But do they just eviscerate the Bucks on the other end of the court when he's out there by getting him switched on to Kyrie or Harden or whatever? And like, do the Bucks just find a way to keep him back in some sort of trap coverage and move guys around? And like, can they be disciplined enough to just never leave those top four guys and just let anyone else on the Nets who wants to, besides the big three and Joe Harris, just shoot as much as they want? Like, that would be my strategy, would be to just only cover those four guys in the half court. But I don't know if Bud's up for that. But I mean, like, if they can find a way to keep Brooke on the court for longer than like 25 or 20 minutes a game, they could really bludgeon the Nets, because that's such a huge weakness for them. And any minutes that DeAndre Jordan is out there is a big win for the Bucks, as we saw at times when those teams matched up during the regular season. So, I mean, the Brooke Lopez minutes, I don't know which way it's going to go, but I feel like whichever team can kind of win those minutes relatively is probably going to win the series.
If you're Steve Nash, would you use DeAndre at all in this series?
I mean, they tried him on Giannis in the regular season. Well. Yeah. I mean, he's fine. You know, he's 6 fouls. I think I wouldn't be surprised if he gets thrown it. Like, if Giannis starts really like having an insane game and no one's slowing down Giannis, I wouldn't be surprised if Steve Nash sent DeAndre Jordan in there and just said like just make the guy like just hit him. Like, yeah. I don't care if it's fouls.
If you go to hack a Giannis, then maybe he's the guy you throw out there to do that. But
I don't, or just play like super physical. No, I don't think there's much upside aside from seeing literally how physical can you get with him. Try getting to his head a little bit. Other than that, no.
I think that could backfire, honestly. I mean, like, it's not like DeAndre Jordan is this noted enforcer who his whole career has just been like really intimidating guys like that come in the
complete opposite
area.
Of anything.
So I just. And when they had, to Nick's point, like when they had Jordan out there with Giannis, like the only thing they can do is have Jordan just hang back, and then they would just bring Chris Middleton up to, you know, get a foul line jumper uncontested, basically, because it would be 2-on-1. And yeah, I have no idea what the right move is for them with those front court rotations, because it's, I mean, like Nick Claxton's probably better than DeAndre Jordan, but it, I mean, he's just going to get eaten alive too. Like he's not strong enough to check Lopez or Giannis on the other end either. So I don't really know what you do. I mean, you're basically going to just have to try to outscore them. Like you're not stopping those Bucks bigs down low. You just have to hope that you're trading twos for threes.
So Giannis goes 1 of 16 from 3 in round 1 against Miami. They win 3 of those 4 games very easily. Didn't really matter. How important is it that he shoots the 3 even passively in this series?
I think it's important that he doesn't shoot any 3s. personally, okay. I think he should just not. Like, I'm okay with shoot. Hey, if he wants to shoot 1 a game, whatever, do it. But there's just no reason for it.
Well, I think we're talking about like if DeAndre's out there, or they'll likely do the same thing with Blake to some degree. Like if they're backing off 8 feet from him, like it seems like he can't resist the temptation to just try to hit 1 or 2. And I'm with you on this in general, Alex, because even if he goes 3 for 3 to start the game, if you're the Nets, I don't think you're changing your coverage and suddenly saying we have to run out there on him. Like, I don't think that ends up benefiting you.
I don't think this is a Giannis should never try to improve his 3-point shot going forward type of thing. I just don't think this is not the series to prove that point. And they can get such good looks even when they're playing off. Like, even when Blake or DeAndre or whoever is daring Giannis to shoot, he can still just dribble in and do a dribble handoff or just a quick pick and pop to Chris or Drew or whoever. Like, they can get amazing looks from that coverage without it being a wide open three from him. And like, one a game is fine, whatever. But if he's taken four a game, that's playing right into the Nets' hand.
I mean, you can try dribble handoffs. Yeah. Like, you can shorten the pick and roll that way too. Like, if you can start or like a dribble handoff and then Giannis rolls, if you can do that at like 15 feet, you know, I mean, if you can do that with Chris Middleton, who's like automatic from 15 feet. And then if someone comes out to play defense on him, you have a Giannis, you know, alley-oop at the rim. There's a lot of different ways you can play it. Like, Giannis shooting threes, it still feels like a gimmick to me. It feels like something to like almost hype him up and hype the crowd up. You know, it's like pretty comparable to like, you know, like if Shaq shot 1-3 a game, like the crowd would just love it if he made it. But like, you're never like, well, that's honestly how it feels to me.
Isn't it kind of one of those things too, where like maybe the worst thing for the Bucks would be for him to hit like three of his first five threes in the series, and for him to just think, all right, this is where it happens. This is where I proved to everyone I can shoot threes.
That goes back to my point where, like, if you're the Nets, I think that's exactly what you want. You know, you're not, what would it take? Like, how many games in a row would Giannis have to go 5-for-5 before you say, like, we got to start closing hard on this guy? Like, it would take a full season of that for me to believe that.
Yeah. You don't because you can't, like, one, if he becomes that good from three, then he's basically the best player ever. And you just have to assume it's going to regress. And, you know, if he's hitting threes like that, then you're just not winning. No matter what you do, if he's hitting threes at like a 40% clip, you're just not winning.
All right, Alex, let's finish out. You've compiled some trivia for us based on the 2021 NBA playoffs. So I'll let you take it from here.
Sure, just some interesting stuff I saw when I was digging through, mostly Clean the Glass, but also a little bit of NBA.com. I guess Nick will have you guess first. Who is the only player, this is of players who have played at least 100 playoff minutes, the only player to not have an assist?
Oh, man. I don't know that he...
I'll tell you, it's a starter.
Oh, okay. I was going to say Melo, and I didn't know if he got to 100 minutes. Man, a starter. How about Robert Covington?
It is not. James, do you have a guess?
Yeah, I need to hold on.
Okay. I will tell you, Covington has the highest turnover percentage in the playoffs. 20% of his used possessions are turnovers.
My God.
let's see. I want to give this, I want to have it be a legitimate guess that I don't feel terrible about. I have one name I'm thinking.
It's my Eastern de facto Conference.
Guess. Eastern Conference. It's an Eastern Conference center, and I'm going to guess Daniel Gafford.
It is Brooke Lopez. Does not have a single assist in the NBA playoffs so far. Okay.
That's because that makes a ton of sense, actually, because he pretty much shoots when he gets the ball. That's pretty much what he does.
Yeah, him and Bryn Forbes kind of have that in common. Okay, Nick, who do you think has been the most efficient player in the playoffs? This is points per shot attempt. I got two hints. This player is 24 of 24 at the rim, has not missed a shot from there, and he leads the playoffs in block percentage.
Okay. I was going to say Ayton at first, but... Rudy Gobert?
It is not Rudy Gobert. Good guess, though. How about you, James? What do you think?
Is it a center?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not tricky that way.
Clint Capella?
I guess someone you guessed before is Daniel Gafford.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I was thinking maybe Rob Williams, but I don't know if he's had
any. I know. I can't believe the Bulls just gave away Daniel Gafford. Very strange.
Yeah.
Okay. Who is the only player in the playoffs less efficient than Julius Randle? This is points per shot attempt. What do you think, Nick?
James, if you have a guess right away, I'll let you take this one first.
Is it a Laker?
Could be a Laker.
It's got to be a Laker.
Yeah. Which Laker, though?
What is the statistical caveat?
At least 100 minutes played in the playoffs. Okay.
And in terms of like less efficient, meaning like field goal percentage?
Fewest points per shot attempt. Kind of like true shooting.
Okay.
Kuzma.
It is Kyle Kuzma.
Yes.
Okay. Only because KCP hasn't played enough minutes.
That might be the case. Okay, I don't have the actual numbers for these next two, but I know the names. We'll give it to you again, James, first. Who do you think leads the NBA playoffs in net rating of players that have played at least 100 minutes? And I will tell you right off the bat, Joel Embiid does not make the minutes qualifier, or else he would be number one.
And that this is the points per shot attempt one?
No, this is leads the playoffs in net rating.
Oh, net rating.
Yeah. So it would be Joel Embiid, but he does not qualify because in his four games, he's only played 23 minutes a game.
Drew Holiday.
It is Drew Holiday, who is, I think, plus 30-ish.
Oh. I was going to guess campaign.
I mean, it feels like it. It definitely feels sure like does. It. Okay.
The eye test says campaign.
Conversely, Nick, who has the worst net rating in the NBA playoffs?
Is it a Laker?
No, I will say it helps to think of series that are lopsided.
Yes.
I have a guess.
Jimmy Butler?
No, not Jimmy Butler.
Okay. James, go ahead.
Tyler Hero.
Not Tyler Hero. As a player, I'm going to give you guys one more guess each on this one. This team is still in play, and it is an Eastern Conference team.
So it's got to be the Wizards or a Celtic.
But which Wizard or Celtic?
It's got to be somebody who's out there a ton. It's disrespectful to guess this, but could it be Westbrook?
It is not Westbrook. I love the guess, though.
Okay.
That is a solid guess. How about Rui Hachimura?
It is not. It is Tristan Thompson.
Sorry. I wanted us to guess this out. Thompson would not have been my first Celtics guess, but interesting.
Yeah, I mean, he's just been out there so much without Rob Williams. It's just he's not made for that series. That's like the one player who just like can't punish, cannot punish the Nets.
Yeah, the Celtics. That's another pod for us to tackle. I think just what becomes of that future. But yeah, I like this, Alex. We should keep this up.
If the Nets win the finals, there should be an asterisk noting that they lost one game to the Celtics team.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. All right, guys. Appreciate you both taking the time tonight. We got a 3-game slate ahead of us. So Alex and I think we'll probably be back on Wednesday, just doing a quick recap of everything that happened Tuesday night. And then we'll be back for our regular Thursday and Friday shows as well.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.